Ahoy, fellow sleep paralysis demon!
And welcome aboard the Joy of Trek, an insomniac podcast exploring the eyes in the dark and one moon circles of Star Trek.
All of it. I'm Kaki.
I'm Kay.
And hiding from Guinan's rifle is your chief engineer, Greg.
Together, we're on a mission through the Titan's Rift of Star Trek to find the hydrogen every Bussard collector
and
the excellent in every episode.
Even the collapsing ceilings.
Because every episode must be someone's favorite, and it might as well be us.
So hold on to your space-bound Betazoid and join us as we float into...
The Joy of Trek.
What was the collapsing ceiling about, do you think?
I mean, maybe after Guinan shot it.
Yeah, probably.
That sounds like a good reason to collapse if I were a ceiling.
Oh.
And we didn't even get to see setting two.
Have you guessed what we're going to talk about this episode?
Just look around. No, wait, wrong show again.
Because in today's episode, let's do it the other way around. Let's do the synopsis first.
All right.
And see if there's an extra clue in there.
Yeah.
The Enterprise is trapped in a rift. The crew succumbs to REM sleep deprivation. And Deanna has a recurring nightmare. It is season 4, episode 17 of Star Trek The Next Generation, Night Terrors.
Right, which is...
Ooh.
Okay, like...
Spooky.
Yes. Also, nobody has a single night terror in the entire episode.
Are you already... No, the other one.
Actually, I don't really have a lot of warp core.
I say we eject the warp
core. There you go.
If anything, there would be that. Well, the only really thing that I can, like, really bitch about is that we completely ignore the fact that there are many different species on board.
I had the exact same thing. Yes, so you have a shared warp core here.
Yeah.
Not everybody's going to have the same brain.
Guinan doesn't seem to be particularly affected. She's her calm, level-headed self. There must be dozens of other alien races on board.
Oh, yes. Okay. Because we're sort of falling into the trap that we usually do with these warp core dumps, is they're utterly incomprehensible if you haven't just watched the episode.
Oh, right. Yes.
Because this is an episode where people are, like, deprived of...
Sleep. REM sleep. Like, there should be plenty of aliens aboard who just don't do REM sleep because, you know...
Yeah. Right. How do Vulcan brains do sleep? Like, I remember... I don't know where it's from exactly, but I remember, like, I think some Vulcan children asking a human at some point, like, is it true that you spend half your lives asleep? Like, clearly...
Right.
A game of telephone having misunderstood something.
Yeah.
But apparently, like, maybe to Vulcans, humans sleep an awful lot.
Yeah, I guess so. It's kind of lampshaded at one point by a cutoff remark that...
REM sleep occurs at a different frequency for Betazoids than for other humanoids.
Oh, okay.
Like, yeah,
yeah,
so that, all no, other humanoids dream on the same frequency,
turns out,
except...
Turns out, yes. Like, it's too bad that we didn't have a Denobulan on board, because they can go weeks without.
Right.
But then they really need their one or two days of, not hibernation.
But very long sleep, yeah.
Do you know hibernation? Like, that it's specifically winter.
Yes.
And there's a form of summer torpor as well called estivation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, never, I had no idea.
Yeah, in the same way that some animals try to survive the winter with its paucity of calories, other animals try to survive the summer with its excess of heat.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So Night Terrors first aired on March 18th, 1991, written by Shari Goodhart's, teleplay by Pamela Douglas and Jerry Taylor. I think these are all women. I think this is an all-woman writing outfit.
Okay.
Directed by Les Landau and has some interesting guest actors.
Oh, do tell.
Well, if we immediately... zap into the episode. The first one shows up, and that's Ensign Rager. She's the black woman.
Right.
Sitting on the operations station, or is that the helm? Like, whichever one's next to...
Is she the actual astronaut?
No, no. But you do recognize her. This is Lene Chapman, and she's Damphoose from Space Above and Beyond.
Oh, right, yes.
She gets next to nothing to do here, which
shame.
Is such
a...
Because she's a phenomenal actress.
Oh, yes.
We had John Vickery as Andras Hagen. He's the patient who's brought on board.
Oh, the other Betazoid.
The other Betazoid, right. Mm-hmm. And he's Naroon from Babylon 5.
Oh.
Member of the warrior caste.
Right.
Complex layered character. And apparently there's also like an Ensign Lin played by Brian Tochi, who previously played as a child actor a role in the original series and the children's elite.
Oh, that's kind of... So he's one of the people who has played in multiple... Which used to be mostly bit actors until they started. It used to be the actors who came in only for an episode and who played the aliens.
Ah, like
who
so,
were the
yeah.
ones who played in multiple series until they started. Then, Worf and O'Brien in Deep Space Nine. And then later they started, like, bringing them back more
rotating
and more.
Rotating more, yeah. A bit difficult with Voyager, just logistics.
Right.
Quite far away. Yeah. But they still found creative ways to do that.
Mm.
Hey.
Yes.
Was this episode f***ing boring, or was it just me?
Jonathan Frakes called it a yawner.
A yawner, yeah. I saw that because I have the book that quote is from. I got it from Lauren Rivers. Thank you so much for sending that. Yeah.
Although it was both in the top five worst Star Trek Next Generation episode and in the top five scariest Next Generation episodes.
Ah.
So...
I saw some bits with, I think, Rick Berman. Maybe you've seen those quotes as well during your research.
Mm-hmm. I don't think so, but yeah.
That the crew had just come back from Christmas break.
Yeah.
So none of them were pretending to be sleep deprived because
they all were.
Absolutely.
Everyone did look a bit frazzled here and there, yes.
Well, I'm sure the makeup department had something
to
say about that.
Yes.
But also, like he mentioned, and I don't know whether he was being hyperbolic, but that like sleep deprivation stories are like some of the most common stories that Star Trek Writers' Room got pitched.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
I guess you write what you know.
I guess. Oh, that's a good point, yes. And it's a good way to like show people at their worst, I suppose.
Yeah, because we need more of that.
So the Den of Geek, sorry.
Wow, who's sleep-deprived now?
The episode was weird and was critical of the Troy dream sequences and outfits. A remark about Troy's sleep attire, a sleeveless halter neck with a choker-style collar. Did she just come back from clubbing?
That was an amazing nightie she's got on.
It must be uncomfortable. I mean, she's definitely not a belly sleeper because like having that like big, heavy brooch thing or whatever it is.
Oh, also that.
That can't be comfortable when you're sleeping. Like, you should just remember that you'd, like, roll over and suddenly that thing's gotten cold and it, like, lands right on your chest. And it's like,
yikes.
Straight awake. So, horrible sleeping attire, but...
Chief Engineer Greg here. Want to chime in because, as a cosplayer, there's a specific outfit that Padme Amidala's cosplayers from Star Wars complain about. It's, like, her, like, sleep nighty in episode 3. And there's literal pearls on it, so everyone I know that cosplays it, they're always complaining just, like... You can't sleep in this. These pearls are so uncomfortable to lay down on, even for just like half a second for like a photo or whatever. Just like, these suck. Why would anyone sleep on them?
I find a lot more cool sort of trivia about it, but let's dive into the episode.
Yeah.
Okay, now can properly push that.
All right.
Oh, I've got my phone as well. I can do it here. Okay, well, that's a bit more convenient.
The Enterprise is responding to the distress call of the Britain.
Yeah. Now, technically, that's the Brattain. But due to a little
spelling
sort of
error
snafu,
on the hull.
On the hull, it was painted the Britain, and that's now also what it says on the subtitles here.
Right.
So that's kind of lost.
Yes.
So it's not the...
And I do believe I saw something about this being actually a model which was also used in Wrath of Khan.
Oh, yeah.
Same model? Yeah.
Yep.
When they still use models. Oh.
Is that? Yeah, it was a redress of the Miranda-class USS Reliant from the Wrath of Khan. And I think later on the explosion that we see at the very end is also a reused footage from the Genesis explosion.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I've always loved the Miranda-class. Like, it's a really cool sort of compact. She looks fast. She looks strong, and she looks kind of lonely, floating around.
What do Miranda classes do? Is it research and exploration, I suppose? Because it's only got like a 34-head crew, I believe, here. At least in this case. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that's the standard complement, but it's going to be in that order of magnitude.
Yep. And they're fast. They're long-range, rapid response.
So they just go warp line, just like everybody else.
Well, I don't know. I mean, they don't have to bother with a huge, like, engineering section. Just don't worry about it, man.
The ship is intact, sir, with no indication of structural damage.
Engines?
All propulsion systems are shut down. The ship is drifting, sir.
Life form readings?
Inconclusive.
Deanna Troi is sitting up straight, and she detects...
There's definitely someone alive, yes.
And she doesn't finish any of her sentences.
Yeah.
But she does feel that she needs to come.
Yes. After Riker gets sent off with the away team, Deanna goes, I'm coming too.
And she says, I need to come too.
Yes.
And Riker goes, well, you know, reciprocation is standard operating procedure in Casa de Riker, so off we go.
Yes, on the bridge, they find a gruesome scene. People with blades sticking out of their chests. People have been shot by phasers, at least setting 6 or 7.
Yeah. I kind of like this setup, because it's kind of a... It's a little bit of a lazy setup.
It's the bridge.
So we see the console, right? The aft console, and that's where our heroes beam down. And they're clearly, like, not looking ahead of them where all the corpses are.
Yeah.
Until they sort of walk to the side, and the camera follows them. And this is all, like, a single shot. It follows Riker, who spots, oh, here's a corpse that he doesn't remark on. Yeah. And then Worf says, oh, here's another one.
Yeah.
And then, oh, there's loads that we could have easily seen. But I kind of like, you know, this gradual sense of
also,
discovery.
Also, can't life form scanners detect dead bodies?
Apparently not.
Okay. Sounds unlikely, but who knows? I mean, we don't know how long they've been dead for.
Yeah.
I mean, the Distress Scrolls were sent 29 days ago. Things were getting pretty bad on the Enterprise after about 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah.
As they mentioned, at some points, it's been stuck for 10 days, and then they don't quite resolve it immediately. So I'm guessing that the Enterprise was stuck there for about 2 weeks.
I mean, I don't know how much we're supposed to draw from the makeup of these corpses, these deceased officers, because, you know, human blood oxidizes brown.
Yeah, pretty quickly too, so.
A fact that is left out of most of Hollywood because, I mean, it just doesn't look very appetizing.
No, I guess not. Like, HP sauce must be cheaper than fake
blood. No, but like, blood looks like poop because poop is mostly blood.
Oh, I see what you mean, right.
Your poop is that, not to gross anyone out, but it's that color because you're pooping out a bunch of dead blood cells.
Yeah, no, okay, fair point.
And so that's pretty hard to...
But yes, the one survivor
is found in the closet. Deanna finds.
Yes, who also turns out to be a Betazoid.
I mean, he doesn't get a lot to do.
No, he just lets... I mean, I guess he gets to lay there, he gets to mumble a little bit and do a voiceover, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of cool that they let him do his own voiceover.
Right, yeah. I was going to say, I hope he wasn't paid per line.
Isn't there a thing about that?
I don't know. I think there's something about like how much lines you have if you have more than...
Oh, you have to have 5 lines, and then you get a guest's cast.
Or something like that,
you go up a pay scale.
Right, that was it. Right, so yes, there's a little bit of a mumdy-bumdy going on between...
Your sort of non-committal descriptions of plot happening are sort of descending.
This isn't plot happening. This is just like them standing over the Betazoid.
And usually you go, oh, there's a little bit of this and that and going back and forth, which I, you know, as your friend, recognize as, oh, he's briefly turned his brain off, but he's kept his mouth moving while he's looking at the next Jeef, which is totally valid podcasting technique.
Yeah.
But now you're going bippity-boppity. Adventures ensue.
I'm not getting much, Captain. Few words, disconnected phrases. I can feel his terror, but I can't seem to get through to him.
Oh, yes. This episode solves a mystery.
Oh?
That kept a lot of Star Trek nerds entertained for quite a while. What's the other door for? In sickbay.
In the sickbay. Oh, sorry. I thought you were going to talk about the turbo lift next to the captain's ready room.
Oh, yeah.
So where does the door in sickbay go to?
Turns out, a big old morgue.
Yeah. Fair enough, yeah. Maybe they just repurposed it in morgue. Maybe that's just the overflow for in case there's a big emergency. And right now they're just like, well, we're getting putting some corpses. Because there's no way to store bodies just on the table. They're going to smell the place up something chronic.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you turn down the thermostat.
Yeah, that'll work.
So they're all standing. We've got the captain, we've got Beverly and Deanna standing around this.
You are on an entirely different scene than I am because...
it's just come out of the opening credits.
There's no corpses there. There's just the Betazoid.
Yeah. But it starts off with a corpse being wheeled away. You know, it gets covered.
Oh, right.
Yes. And then wheeled into that mystery door.
Right. Okay.
But yes, on the bio bed is... Wait. Oh. This episode was recommended to us, and we totally forgot to mention that.
Oh, dear. Okay, right, yes.
Oh, please do. Wow.
Yeah, Cocky, I was kind of wondering, like, if you forgot about that, but it turns out your brain just got scared.
Yeah, quick disclosure, I've also been a little bit sleep-deprived of late.
You're not in the best of...
Yeah, but I'm fighting on. So apologies to a friend of the show, Rob McWolf. He is a podcast host of The Voice of Dog, where furry stories are read to the delight of very many. And there's a wonderful community of writers. I have been involved in that in the past.
You started it. That's how we met.
You started.
Modesty prevents me.
Well, that's why I'm saying it.
But so Rob's a fantastic writer and a luminary of the furry writing community. And he says... about this episode, it comes so close to being at that point where space opera crosses over into cosmic horror, but then in a rare example of the reverse Twilight Zone twist, veers away at the last second.
It snatches defeat from the jaws of victory or something like that.
It almost even invents a cosmic horror trope, now commonplace, decades in advance of Night of the Woods, which much more widely disseminated it. The thing you thought was a feature of the landscape all along turns out to have been some being so unfathomably vast that you didn't see it all the while you were looking at it. But even after looking like it's foreshadowing exactly that trope the entire episode, it never does it. The scares, the slow burn of tension, and the acting all prove they could do cosmic horror. There's maybe reasons that have to do with the ethos and goals of Star Trek that explain why they don't, but as someone who loves both cosmic horror and Twilight Zone twists, it's fascinatingly frustrating. And yes,
it's like edging along and never getting quite to the release.
Well, some people are into that.
Mm-hmm. No judgment.
Exactly.
Okay, wait. I'm trying to figure out how to edit this so it's PG-13. Do I leave this in? Sure, let's leave it in. Sure, why not?
But I think, like, pointing out the ethos is valid because mm-hmm. Star Trek has historically, like, firmly planted its little heels on the side of humanism, on the side of science, and that whenever it plays with the supernatural, it's kind of obsessively right. grounded in some kind of scientific explanation.
Of course, because it's... I mean, we saw that in Sub Rosa, you know? Oh, ghost yeah. the ghost in the lamp.
No, oh, it's just plasma. A
psychic plasmic being...
Yeah. So thank you for the recommendation, Rob. Okay, back to the episode. So they're standing around this unconscious person and the captain tasks the empath, Deanna, to hang about. It's yeah. a very slow-burning episode.
It is.
Everybody's sort of hanging about and it doesn't seem to be, like, very urgent.
Not yet. The sense of urgency isn't quite there yet. In the next scene, it's Data, Riker, and Geordi on board the Britain, trying to get her back under her own power. It seems to be fine, and like open the matter valves and open the antimatter valves, and big fat nothing.
There is no engine activity at all, sir.
What's wrong?
Nothing's wrong. I don't understand it.
Yeah, which you'd think. Hey, that yeah. sort of happens on its own, doesn't it?
You'd think so, but you know, I guess the warp core had been shut down. Probably.
You notice that all the consoles have LCARS touch interfaces.
I mean, the same as the Enterprise has.
Yeah, despite yeah. the fact that the Reliant, like, well, that was in service 100 years yeah. ago.
Retrofit?
Yeah, right. Yeah,
it's what cool. they do. It's what they do with old ships. Well, they fit them with more modern communication equipment. Other than that, the bridge had a little bit of the ye olde original series plywood feel.
A little bit, but... I mean, there's a cool sort of drop-down ceiling with a cool red light
Maybe
and,
that's
and
ceiling
green
that's
ribbing.
Coming down.
I've been studying the autopsy reports. The conclusion is appalling. There was no outside source, no alien presence. All 34 of them appear to have killed each other.
Yeah, there's no drugs, asked the captain. Hey, drugs,
yeah.
first thing he thinks of.
Shortly after the war on drugs, I guess.
Alien, spacey, wacy, wibbly, bibbly. No, there's nothing. And they find a captain's log by the captain.
Yeah, who is clearly... going off the deep end because she's...
First Officer Brink and his men were behind it. They got to the engines. They don't work anymore. Had to eliminate Brink.
Well, yeah. you know, kind of know what happened there then.
She's got this cool sort of incoherent speech because it's about her First Officer Brink. They got in the engines, had to eliminate Brink. The ship is we're running out of Brink.
Yeah.
And his men.
And she's kind of like scratching the side of her hair.
Sort of looks like Tiana, you know, when she needs her box to...
Oh, right, yes.
that her fur is covered in poison.
Oh, that old thing. No, it's just I just needed a box.
And then we get the first of quite a few scenes
yes.
of Tiana's dream.
And my first thought was like, oh, it's a Betazoid mind meld. And that she was trying to get into the brain of the other Betazoid.
Oh, that would have been cool.
That's what I thought when this scene... I've probably seen this episode like years and years ago, around the time that it first aired. I think I've pretty much seen all of them.
Yeah.
I think there's any that I've missed, but you know.
We are those kinds of nerds.
It's not particularly memorable, I guess, because I certainly couldn't remember how any of it went.
So these sequences were like a huge coup for Rob Legato, the VFX supervisor. Yeah. Fantastic expert in visual effects, who essentially got like a whole day of second unit shooting, doing these shots with a stunt double for Marina Sirtis, because it's this green cloud environment. Now, of course, we're watching the remastered editions.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much of this is actually from the original special effects, but
good point.
Actually looks really good. And
it does. I mean, you can see that there's a little bit of wire work going on and everything like that, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Marina Sirtis said that her request for more, like, action scenes kind of backfired because they gave her this action sequence and she's terribly afraid of heights.
Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear.
So that look of terror on her face is, well, that's pretty
quite,
genuine.
Quite genuine, yeah. Well, good on her that she managed to act well through it. But yes, two eyes, one moon orbit is basically
one
what the...
moon circle.
So one moon circle.
Eyes that in is, the dark.
Was, yes.
And then she wakes up in that amazing nightie that she's got.
Yeah.
She's got a choker and then, like, a multi-ruff front piece. Like, it's glorious. She's the only one who's getting decent sleep.
Yes. Or at least dreaming still.
Now we get introduced to everybody's sort of losing it. It starts with a little ensign on the bridge of the Bretagne under the command of Geordi LaForge, who says he...
Someone's still here. What did you say, ensign? Can't you hear it? There's someone still alive on the ship.
You hear some banging and scraping noises, like the sounds that someone could make when they were, like, skulking about the ship, I suppose.
And Geordi makes it very clear. No, it's been searched stem to stern.
Yep.
Every self-sealing stem bolt has been unsealed. And
resealed, self-sealed. Or
definitely nothing here.
Yep, we searched the entire place. We even had our Betazoid look around. One of many scenes where... Diana is talking to the catatonic Betazoid.
There's an awful lot of really quite short scenes in this episode.
Yeah, but like also, this scene is more or less repeated in the same way without ever really adding anything. It's just her going and him repeating the same thing.
Look, I think this is a case where if the mystery had been a little bit more stimulating or there'd been more layers to it, or the direction or the photography had been like a little bit more exciting, like this could have actually been built into a lot more like tension.
Right, tension and terror.
Actually
and,
mounting.
Yeah. Well, as we see with Brian O, who has words with Keiko. Keiko, is it?
Keiko.
Keiko, yes.
They've recently married at this point in the series.
And he is... insanely jealous of her because, like, she's a bit late from work because there's been a new project and blah, blah, blah. And the boss is trying to offload another project on it, which she really doesn't have time for.
Was Tom Corbin there?
What?
Tom Corbin from the science lab. Remember him?
Of course I remember him, but...
Use any excuse you can to pay him a visit.
Miles, what are you saying?
I think you know exactly what I'm saying.
Out of nowhere, like, this is so contrary to his personality.
Yes.
And after he'd been, like, pacing back and forth and waiting for her, he walks out on her.
Yes.
So, I mean, all in the day's work for Rosalind Chow. I hope she was well paid for that brief scene. And he says
you take me for a fool.
And he walks out on her, and he goes to the pub.
Yep. Like any good Irishman? Yeah, he's Irish, isn't he?
Yep, yeah, yep.
Yes.
Although, I've got to say... when he's at 10 forward, sitting next to Gillespie, who asks her, are you also coming for coffee?
Yes.
He says, no. There's actually sort of like a little bit of an American twang to his accent.
Right. Well, so, it's Gillespie is a Scottish name, so...
Oh, I mean O'Brien.
Oh, sorry. Right.
You know, specifically when he says that she had work to do, like there's a... he's been spending a lot of time with Americans. It's much less noticeable.
It rubs off.
Yes. So Gillespie is one that we're supposed to pay attention to because he becomes a bit more dangerous later in the episode.
He's the mutinous one later on, yes.
Yeah, I don't imagine that his career advances very much beyond this point on the Enterprise.
I mean, everybody had things you do under influence from aliens. Do they count towards your permanent record?
I mean, they're not supposed to, but...
Yeah. No, I don't think so. I mean, people will still... have an opinion on you after that. But then again, as we all know, first opinions are the one that matters most. You know?
It's
I had that with the boss once. Like, new boss shows up after a corporate takeover, and just make sure that the first few times that you interact with him, you make a sterling example. And whenever later you do anything wrong, it's like, that can happen to anybody. And whenever you do something good, then it's just another example of why you're such a great employee. And
I mean, this is also how, interviewing goes. Like, everybody knows.
Right.
Like, that first impression, you're going to be at your absolute best. we're all going to pretend that that's going to be the norm. We're going to imagine that that's the case. And especially like some, you know, young leaders think, oh, I can fix him. Fat chance, darling.
Yes. Meanwhile, Picard's mind is playing a game of ding-dong-ditch with him.
Come.
Everybody's coming this episode. Yes. I guess you can't really come. Sleep. You gotta...
I think he always says come when he went to answer the door. But
Greg, can we have a little montage of Picard saying come? You don't have to do all of them, just a whole bunch.
Come. 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 Come.
I think it would be a very long episode if you had to string all of them together, but thank
you. Oh, thank you.
And I have to give a thank you to a YouTube channel, Jibs Compilations, for helping me out with that because, oh, trying to search for just the phrase come in the transcripts would just be a nightmare. So thank you so much, Jibs Compilations, for that help there.
And then again, after it starts happening again, he stalwartly ignores it from that point on.
Because he's actually gone to the door, looked onto the bridge, onto the faces of lots of people who think, okay, any orders forthcoming?
Until there is a knock-knock, and it's the doctor and the counselor standing outside the door, who have this kind of like surprised look on their face, and he's kind of like surprised.
Yeah.
And everybody's a little bit uncomfortable about what just happened. Like, why was he... yeah. Like, the two from outside were wondering, why is he ignoring the door? And he's like, wait... am I going crazy now? Like, this time there is someone there.
And the counselor and the chief medical officer have realized, like, okay, we've sort of put together a pattern.
People behaving strangely, others hearing sounds that aren't there.
Are we talking about hallucinations?
In some cases, and others just erratic behavior.
And the captain says, well, we'll be gone within the hour.
Yeah, we're going to tow the ship out. Because that's what Geordi and the other guy were doing. They were preparing the ship for towing.
There's a lot of scenes that sort of end with a lack of action.
Yeah.
Right? They just end with, okay, now the information's been conveyed and nobody responds to it. It's a little bit, on the one hand, unsatisfying. On the other hand, unsettling. Hey, spooky.
Yeah. Next, we're moving on with getting actually the ship into tractor beam position and the ensign completely forgets how to do her job.
I can't seem to remember how to enter the coordinates, sir.
Yeah, and good on her for admitting that.
Yeah.
Riker immediately gets up, calls over Ensign Lin to take over, and dismisses her to whatever. Like,
yeah,
like this is completely professional behavior.
Yeah. By the way, what are the two positions? Helm and?
Ops, right?
Operation? What's operations do? What does ops do? I don't know.
I don't know. Tractor beam, push, I guess. They're all just pushing buttons.
Oh, right. But this, but Data is setting at the... I mean, what Data?
Helm, navigation. Like
no, the other guys. The other one's doing navigation because they're being told to move into... So viewer's left is the helm console, obviously, because they were putting in helm stuff.
Okay. Yeah. There are a lot of listeners at home screaming into their headphones that this is so well known.
I know, that's why
we have to pretend that we know this stuff. I mean,
no, I don't.
We're just having a little bit of fun to like pretend that we don't already know.
At least in Galaxy Quest, it was very obvious because like there they had the big helm control, and that was on the right side console.
And on Voyager, I think Tom Paris does both the jobs.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, sure.
Are helm and navigation the same job?
No, I guess not.
Right?
Yeah, one steers and the other one tells where to go. But it's usually the captain who tells where to go.
Yeah, but then you've got to plot a course.
Yeah.
Right,
but very often the captain gives specific headings.
Yeah. How wise is that? Because, like, you...
Yeah.
I mean, when you're navigating, like, an interstellar course, you've got to make sure that you also obey all the local treaties and, like, there's the black hole
so
here.
So what you'd expect is, like, yeah, the captain says, take us to Starbase 220, then navigation plots a course, and navigation tells helm...
Left a bit.
Heading 240 Kareem 75, you know?
Yeah. Oh, Karen 75, nice Battlestar Galactica reference. At the end of the current quantum slipstream, turn right.
Yes.
Take the fifth exit transwarp corridor.
You should have taken a left at the last quasar.
What a wanker.
Chief Engineer Greg here. Just have to say, no, Tom Paris is not the only one that does Operation and Helm. It's Harry Kim does Operations and Tom does the Helm. But more importantly, Operations is all the internal system stuff. It is the operations of the ship itself, like all the inside stuff. So it's systems control, communication, sensor, all that stuff. Like when they're scanning, operations takes care of it. That's why Data says like, oh, sensors say this. And that's why Harry says, oh, sensors say this. Like that's what I, so yeah, that's what operations is. I wish one of you had thought to calm me, but apparently I'm just going to interrupt here with my diatribe.
But yes, turns out nothing works.
Nope, it all fails, and...
We have no functional propulsion systems.
No, sir. Apparently we do not.
We're adrift.
Just like the Britain.
Data has a hypothesis. A Tychon's Rift, named after an explorer who encountered this, and it's apparently like a spacey wasty thing.
And he had, luckily he was carrying high explosives and managed to blow up his way out of the... Rift.
Because this spacey wasty thing just sort of sucks up energy, and the thing to do is then to shove so much energy down its throat that it dislodges and lets you go.
Yeah.
But we have none of those components here.
And well, you know what someone should have said at this point?
I say we eject the warp core!
Yeah!
They could have done it with the warp core from the Britain.
They've got a spare one, yeah!
This is one of the few situations where ejecting the warp core might have actually solved the problem.
Yes! But I guess, I mean, maybe it wouldn't work. Maybe that warp core had already been depleted. They opened up all the nozzles for the matter and antimatter.
Right.
Nothing was happening.
Antimatter?
Yeah.
Unless the ship is out of antimatter, the ship always has plenty of matter. So the size of the explosion is limited by the amount of antimatter that you have.
But maybe that's an effect of the rift, that the annihilation does take place, but no energy makes it into this universe.
Right, but the point is, like, if you generate enough, then suddenly there's enough... or maybe it has to be a chemical... Well, no, that makes no difference. Energy's energy. Eh, whatever. Like, we can talk about this forever and we can't reach... But I still say warp core.
Warp core dump. I'm with you.
You've
got a spare one. You might as
well. Exactly.
Well.
They should have just sacrificed the Britain's warp core and used that. But anyway.
Yeah, but not everybody's... everybody except Data isn't firing on all cylinders.
Good point.
We see Worf showing up late and, like, an irritable exchange of glances.
I was detained. No explanation what.
In Tychon's experience, did the crew exhibit behavioral changes?
No. There were no reports of unusual conduct among the crew.
What about nightmares?
There were no records of sleep disturbances of any kind, Counselor.
What is happening to us?
Yes, Riker and Picard have a little heart-to-heart in the turbo lift.
Excellent.
I thought so too, yes, because this is like communication. This is stuff that they're talking about that you normally don't talk about with, because like when you're not performing optimally. But they know, okay, we are in charge of the ship. I need to talk about this. Like, there's captain's responsibility to, like, make sure that, like, he notices that, like, if he's not functioning fine, then he needs to make sure that his first officer knows that and vice versa.
Any hallucinations? Nightmares? No. I'd be a liar if I said I felt like myself. I've had to bite my tongue to keep from snapping at people.
And then they decide that it's Riker's 33 minutes to sleep.
That's a great parallel. Like the first episode proper of Battlestar Galactica, the famous 33, as it's called, where the Cylons show up every 33 minutes and people just haven't slept in 200 cycles of 33.
Jumps,
so, Described by James Callis, who I think later goes on to play Picard's dad.
Oh, okay.
In Picard, called it the perfect hour of television. The perfect hour of television.
It was a fantastic episode. But yes, at one point there, the XO and the commander are talking to each other, and the commander asks, like, is it your turn or my turn to sleep? And the XO goes, it's your turn. And one of the other, after the captain leaves, and one of the other bridge officers goes, like, you know that it's your turn, right? Yeah, but if he can't remember, then he needs it more than I do.
Yeah. So Riker is sent off to bed, but he's kind of twitchy when he gets to his room.
Which doesn't really do anything other than show signs of his fatigue.
Yeah.
Picard, on the other hand, has a lift terror moment. Maybe it was a flashback to the time when he was stuck into the lift with all those kids. No, that hadn't happened yet at this point, I think.
Yeah, I was going to say.
That was a Captain's Day episode, but that's later.
Yeah, this is season 4. I don't know when that happens.
I want to say season 7, but...
Hey, do you think the chief is just sort of sitting there? Ooh, I know. Please call me.
Yes. Go on then, chief.
Kay, your memory is better than mine because I was pretty sure that Captain Picard Day was in an earlier episode. I thought that it was like mid-season to like season 3, something like that. But no, it was the Pegasus, which was season 7. So you are right, and I'll take that. As far as just waiting for you, I was literally pulling up in Memory Alpha because I was just curious myself. I was like, oh, like if they're not going to call me, I'm just going to jump in and interrupt you guys myself. But you guys actually thought to call me. I I'm so lonely here.
Yeah.
Thank you.
it's like the ceiling's coming down. He ducks down, puts his hands up to protect. Oh, this is the collapsing ceiling.
Oh, right. That
from
makes
the
sense.
Script.
Yes.
That,
okay.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. No,
well
that's
done,
fine.
Chief. And then he's just sort of sitting on the ground on his bum.
Arms high above his head while everybody concerned looks from the bridge crew.
Yeah, everyone on the bridge leaves their station to look at the
you
the
can't see.
Captain.
I was just trying to do it like kind of like lean around and look into the drunk.
We see more of Riker trying to get to sleep and he's still all twitchy and oh no.
Snakes. Snakes on this motherfucking starship.
I would have liked it if he had a similar 92 to Troy. By the way, when Picard walks out of the lift, like he doesn't mention the fact that he just sort of sat there screaming and everyone saw, he does call Data into his ready room.
And after Riker has dealt with the snakes, we see that conversation.
And so first it's about, you know, can we find any solution? Can you help us out? And then afterwards he has the much more important conversation. Hey, you're not affected by this sleep issue. I am. And so as the captain, I'm responsible, but I can't execute my responsibility without you.
Yeah, so I'm going to have to rely on you, which is, again, a very good captain move. The solution, of course, is doing something with the main deflector dish, but...
Yeah, as usual. Oh, we can do something with the deflector dish. Oh, we'll just do that then.
Yeah, why not?
Another horror scene.
Yes.
Yeah, in the morgue, in the morgue. In the mystery room. It's got a nice tall ceiling, this
It looks a bit like... Actually, it looks a bit like a set that they would use for cargo.
Could be.
Yeah, maybe not. So, yes.
So 12 of these beds draped with sheets.
Count them?
Was it?
I don't know. I mean, it's like, I don't know. But yes.
3 times 4 is 12.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Which all suddenly sit upright, giving Beverly quite a fright.
Yeah, and then she closes her eyes and she says,
"Go away."
That's a pretty good technique for,
I know.
Hallucinations, terrors, or whatever.
I mean, that's what I used when I was a kid and I had nightmares, you know.
Yeah.
It's also still the reason I can't lucid dream anymore, because the moment I realize that I'm in a dream, I wake up, because I trained myself to as a kid.
Oh, well done.
That was an anti-nightmare method for me. It's like, as soon as I realize that I was in a dream, then it's like, wake up. It's a dream. Wake up.
Oh, good job.
Yeah. So no lucid dreaming for me, unfortunately.
No. I don't think I've ever managed lucid dreaming, but I've
been close. But yeah, usually around the time when I start going to that, then it's like when I start realizing, like, oh wait, that means I'm dreaming. Wake.
Yeah. Well, I do have moments where I realize, hey, hang on, this is all fucking ridiculous. The stakes are never this high in my life. This is probably a dream.
Yes.
And I'll just wait for it to be over.
Yeah, that works. Technology failure is a patent thing to recognize that you're dreaming. Technological things like cars and guns and stuff doesn't tend to work right in dreams.
I have been blessed by the universe with a dream. And I don't want to turn this into a podcast where a bunch of people talk about their funny dreams, but this is one that I've regaled our chief engineer with to his great delight, because it's imagery that will stay with me for the rest of my life. I was biking toward the swimming pool in my village, and in the bicycle parking lot, there were not bicycles. There were a bunch of stormtroopers and Darth Vader and a TIE fighter.
Wow.
And I climbed into the TIE fighter and I tried to fly away, but it wouldn't fly very high and it sort of scraped over the ground. And so I kept looking behind me to find Darth Vader on a moped, cape billowing behind him.
Chasing you because you were making off with his TIE fighter.
An image that I will one day have commissioned. I will never type it into an AI generator. I will.
Very good point.
I will entrust this only to a person who understands the majesty and arrangement.
Beverly and Data and Picard are sitting in his ready room, and this is where the whole dream scenario starts coming out.
She's figured it out, but she buries the lead. She goes, hey, have you had a dream recently?
Yes.
I bet you haven't. But nobody has. In fact, I know for sure that nobody has.
Yes.
It's kind of deranged.
Everybody's deranged, so like that's excusable in this scenario.
And I love that Data's there, because in any other situation, this would be pretty horrible mansplaining.
Yes.
Because she sort of runs out of sentence and he says, I think what the doctor's trying to say is a very, very typical phrase. But in this case, you know, he's functioning as almost an assistive device.
He's standing there as an observer also to record what's being said. And like, because Picard also knows that he won't be able to reliably relate anything that he's been told right here. So,
yeah.
I don't think Data ever gets officially appointed to being acting captain, at least not on screen.
No, but he does identify himself as such, so it must have been...
No, I get that, but...
It's understood to have happened.
Yes.
And the realization is, like, there's just nothing we can do about it. We're not recharging our brains.
She's tried everything. It's like tried inducing sleep and doing other things.
And there's this utter helplessness at being unable to prevent your deterioration. Picard talks about it when he asks Data for help.
I remember watching my grandfather deteriorate from a powerful, intelligent figure to a frail wisp of a man who could barely make his own way home.
Yeah.
Yeah. Diana's talking to the other Betazoid again and not getting very far.
There's this woman lying on the biobed. I hope that she's consented to the various experiments that Beverly has just performed, or maybe in her sleep-deprived state, she just sort of forgot to get consent.
I mean, or she is, you know, in sick bay because she is sick, and therefore, you know, the doctor needs to do... And it wouldn't be that hard. It's like, you've not been dreaming. I'm going to do a few things that usually work to help people dream.
Yeah.
And see if we can get you dreaming.
You're sleep-deprived. I think you should do drugs about it.
Yes, exactly. Mr. Gillespie, in the meantime, is...
Oh, he's holding court in 10-4.
He is starting to become a little bit rebellious.
He is QAnoning,
saying
Picard is experimenting on all of us and the reptile people, which, you know, in Star Trek is not that weird. You've actually got reptile people.
True. Plenty.
And they probably do have some with the monarchy. So, you know, a bit ahead of his time is Gillespie. Guinan is perfectly reasonable.
Yeah.
I mean, she's... No, this is nonsense. That's nonsense. The voice of reason, who has rarely been successful in the face of misinformation of this scale.
Yes, unfortunately. Geordi is also starting to fail because he can't remember the name of the main deflector dish, even though that's the thing that they use most on board of the entire ship.
Nothing. Just fizzled out.
Captain, it appears the energy output has been absorbed into the rift.
Yeah. Because the deflector dish jizzes and it just doesn't do anything.
Worf runs off in a panic to go kill himself.
Yeah. Which, on the one hand, fucking ridiculous. On the other hand, this moment reminded me actually a lot of, not to go Battlestar Galactica again.
Oh no, I'll be at the replicator.
In season 4, after they've pinned all their hopes on finding what they hope is Earth, and then, spoiler, they find it and it's a nuked out wasteland.
Yeah.
And just the despair that sets in as the last hope that people have been holding on to for years is ripped away. Because that was it. You know, he was trying to hold on until they did this deflector dish and it failed and there's nothing.
Yep.
Chief Engineer Greg here. I do just want to give a little heads up. The next 5 minutes contains discussion of a failed suicide attempt by Commander Worf. While this is unsuccessful, I do just want to make sure that everyone's aware that this is a discussion that we are having. If you're not in a place where you are ready to hear about anything like this, then please skip ahead about 5 minutes and we'll continue the discussion. And we here at the Drive Track want you to know that you are loved and you are cared for.
To admit that you're afraid gives you strength.
Something is waiting for us. I am not strong enough to fight it.
No, Worf. It's just an illusion. It's not real.
He just has a ready-to-go suicide kit.
I'm not sure. Like, okay, so I was just thinking about that, if I was going to comment on that. Like, is this because that's just how he always keeps his room? Or is this, has he already been preparing this? And has he already set everything out here because he's been struggling with this for longer?
Oh, interesting. I mean, it may just be like a sort of standard ritual setup because he has a little box with a Duktag dagger in it.
Yes, which is, okay, yeah, I guess that's the Klingon bris knife that they have.
Of course. And two vases, one of which he uses to anoint his blade.
I wouldn't call them vases, I'd more call them very elaborate champagne flutes. But
oh, nice, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'd use them for. I mean, you can put like one flower in them, so it's not much of a vase.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, so...
Which presumably contains some sort of poison, which is a cool thing to just leave lying around in your room.
Alexander
is
not on board at this point in time, it seems, so...
Did you hear his name?
Alexander Sheen.
As you raised this dagger up, is this a duck? Its beak pointed toward me.
Alexandrian is how it's spelled.
I don't know what that suffix is.
It sounds a bit Slavic, to be honest, but I'm not sure if that's...
Huge poo.
Pu is my. That's the suffix for the possessive.
Yeah.
Jich-e, I don't know that one.
My little Alexander, maybe?
Alexandrian, yeah.
And then he stands there like as if he's going to stab himself in the throat with it.
Well, he'd have to do something. Man, Klingons have a lot of redundant organs. It's not easy to kill a Klingon.
Unless the plot needs it.
Well, yeah. Unless there's a very light sort of barrel. But yeah, Deanna, she felt something when Worf just abandoned his post, informing no one. She walks in, tells him to stop, immediately calls for security.
Basically goes, it's not real.
Yeah. And Worf's position is like, that doesn't matter. Like,
I'm no longer a warrior. I'm no longer strong.
He's unfit. And apparently the Klingons have like a tradition for, or you know, a social construction for life ending.
Although that again might be being not entirely used in the proper way because if, you know, he's not in the right state of mind for it.
Yes.
He might just like, they might have something for that, but it's not necessarily something that would be done in a situation like this.
She asserts to him something that, you know, makes a lot of sense to us as humans, but might not make so much sense to a Klingon, that the fact that he's confronting his fear, that he's expressing that, is a display of strength. Security shows up, and she dismisses them.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I mean, they don't sort of stick around and, like, for her to blink the code for...
Probably standing outside the door, you know, just in case. You know, it's like, do you have anything else we need to go, like, right now? No, okay, let's just, like, wait here outside the door then, shall we? At least that's what I would do if it wasn't secured in a security detail like that.
Exactly.
You know, you just kind of, like, hover. It's like in situations where you're, like, on the welfare team at conventions.
Oh, and then, yes,
you know,
exactly.
It's like, you know, when someone's, like, you know, taking care of the situation, you kind of like hover around. Make sure you don't get in the way. Just make sure that you don't get in the way, but that you're close by in case more assistance is required.
And she asks him,
"Let me take you to sickbay."
Yeah.
And he takes her hand and he goes with her, which I think is really tremendous. Because, yeah, it's culturally a huge stigma. It's also a significant blow to his ego.
Well, if he's a strong warrior, he can take a hard blow.
Not how it works for everyone, unfortunately.
All right, more medical blah, blah.
This must have been... Okay, because Deanna's at the bedside of Andras Hagen again, and it must have been very frustrated because they have mental dialogue that neither of them are saying.
Yes.
So I wonder if they sort of recorded it in advance.
I would hope so.
And sitting there listening to themselves and trying to faces.
Yeah, that's how you film music videos, so... Yeah. So it turns out that he's having the same dream as she is, and she
circles.
Oh, hey, hang on, something is going on.
My nightmare. It's not a dream. It's not a dream at all. It's a message.
And she gets Beverly, who's pacing back and forth, and Data and Picard.
We are being frequency fed this, and it must be aliens.
It must be aliens.
Yes. So I guess this week's boots of conclusion jumping go to Deanna.
So she surmises.
There may be another ship on the other side of the fissure where we cannot detect it.
Conveniently enough, can't see it. And they're trying to communicate.
Yeah.
Telepathically, which is unblockable. Yeah.
Yeah. But and it's also sucking up the REM rays from everybody on board, or it's interfering with them.
Exactly.
Meaning that humans can't get into REM sleep.
Non-betazoid humanoids. I love this, because this is so plausible. This idea that someone is sending a distress signal that's so loud that nobody else can communicate on the same channel.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Right?
Good point. Troy and Data are looking together at things that could make a big explosion.
These are the elements we have available. Some of them could be used in the creation of an explosive reaction.
He must be doing it like at a vastly reduced rate, because we've seen Data read, and so he must be keeping it down to a speed that Deanna can keep more or less keep up with.
She doesn't seem to be particularly interested
until she spots who? What's that?
One moon circles.
Yes, Counselor. One electron circles one proton. This is a hydrogen atom.
Hydrogen really blows up if you mix it together with made-up elements.
Hydrogen... Hey, hydrogen loves to blow up.
True.
Hydrogen's like a real slut for other things in the universe, you know?
Yeah. I mean, statistically, there's nothing else in the universe, so...
Noise, right?
Yeah, it's well below statistical significance.
Because, it's a single proton, a single electron. And, okay, here we do actually run into something where I may have to dump a warp core.
Okay.
Because they surmise, okay, what if this other ship is already doing the same work that we're doing? They've already identified a possible explosive. They can't do it on their own. So are they saying what they have or are they saying what they need?
And actually, I think that, like, Diana's reply to that is perfectly valid. It's like...
Well, if it's a distress call, I think they'd be asking for what they need, not what they already have.
But that's a cultural assumption.
Yeah.
Right? That's based on how we organize our needs. Because, yeah, when you send a distress signal, you usually talk about what you want, what you what you need and expect. But that's not necessarily always the case. I mean, sometimes you advertise what you've got.
Right. I suppose. You know, when you try to get rid of it, that's what you sell. And like, oranges, oranges, lovely oranges,
right,
£2
exactly.
of bananas.
To a Ferengi, that might be the way that you do distress signals. You know, what are you offering for your rescue?
Hmm, good point. Yes. So, I mean, we'd already awarded the boots of conclusion jumping to Diana, so I guess we're like she's allowed to keep wearing them for a little bit longer.
Oh, actually, I've got a resolution.
Oh?
Yeah, they're trying to convey the simplest thing that they can do.
Doesn't get much simpler than hydrogen.
Right, exactly. Yeah. They looked at all the chemicals that they have and all the chemicals that they could ask for, and they just found the simplest one to make it as easy as possible. Because these aliens on the other side, they've been broadcasting one moon circling for a month and a half by now.
Something like that, yes.
Dead
but
boring.
I also assume that they must be expecting their telepathic signal to go a lot further. Because the other thing that they say is two eyes in the darkness, which Data at one point mentions.
Eyes in the dark could mean this twin star system.
So that suggests that they're trying to get this information out there to someone who might be able to hear that at a long distance and think, okay, where's it coming from? It's like two eyes in the darkness. Oh, there's a binary star system over there.
Oh, you think it's a distress? Oh, yeah, that's actually brilliant. So, yeah, they were sending this distress signal. Hey, go to wherever there's two eyes in the dark and then dump a bunch of hydrogen in.
Exactly.
And then we'll take care of the rest. Oh, that's actually kind of... See, I thought it was a way to convey this is a signal.
Okay.
Right? This is not a thought that you're having.
No,
we're imposing.
Yeah.
But here's the signal. In the way that, there was a thought experiment. Some NASA person was asked, like, if you ever bump into aliens, what are you supposed to do?
Yeah.
And they ran through, like... Okay, try and discern, you know, what are they? Do you see markings on them? Okay, then maybe they've got eyes.
Yeah.
And maybe they can see what you're doing. And then you want to convey that you're aware of the universe. So what you want to do is you want to draw the solar system, but make all the orbits ovals.
Yes.
Really exaggerate it.
So showing that you know that they're not perfect circles.
They're not circles. Yes. That shows that you're, you know, another level of awareness of the universe.
Yeah, yeah. Clever.
But, okay, they have a fantastic device that a very, very tired Beverly is gluing to Deanna's head.
A cortical scanner is what she calls it.
Data has the bad news, like, hey, once you're in REM sleep, you've got 2 minutes.
2 minutes, because we only have hydrogen for 2 minutes.
Yeah, because otherwise we run out of power.
Or hydrogen.
Yeah, we only have power to emit hydrogen for...
They have to cut off life support only to the designated shelters.
Ah, yes, which includes 10 Forward, where Gillespie is sort of mounting his January 6th riot. Security shows up at the request of Guinan, and a fist fight breaks out. Fortunately, it's a lot of double fist punches.
Yeah, and Guinan, fortunately, has her little shotgun behind the bar.
It's so cool!
Yeah.
This is a little souvenir I picked up from Magus 3.
She fires at the ceiling.
That was setting number one. Anyone want to see setting number two?
It's so cool. Of course the bartender has a shotgun behind her bar.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, I assume this must have been licensed by Picard, that she has this. Because I don't think, I mean, she is like NCO at most. I mean, if she's even commissioned.
No, she's a civilian.
Yeah, she's a civilian. So like a civilian having a firearm of that caliber on a Federation ship. I'm sure that the captain must have okayed it. I mean...
I don't know, man. I mean, she seems like the kind of person who's resourceful enough to get away with this.
Or it might just be an obscure enough weapon that it doesn't show up on the regular weapon scans.
Exactly. She picked one that's... all plastic components and ooh.
Right. When Beverly detects that Diana has gone into REM sleep, they start the hydrogen pump.
From the buzzard collectors.
Right.
Activating buzzard collectors.
Incorrect, Data. That's not how you pronounce buzzard collectors.
Ah.
You pronounced it correctly, Kay.
Oh.
Well done.
Which is, I believe, a soup strainer in the original model. And
I think in this continuity, like, they normally like collect little bits of hydrogen and whatever to recharge their deuterium tanks.
That seems to make sense. Well, as you're flying around, you might as well like put some ram scoops up there so to collect your fuel.
And Deanna flies through these clouds. I have to find you to tell you, wasting a lot of time.
Just start shouting back at them, But we vaguely see a humanoid shape forming in the green light, and then the power runs out. Like, that's it. We've had our 2 minutes of hydrogen pumping.
She doesn't say now, which was the message that she was supposed to convey. But apparently she did, off screen. That was
Or the aliens maybe went like, oh, look, this like hydrogen thing that we've been wanting for is suddenly pouring out through the rift.
Oh, but they can't observe it, right? Because the aliens are on the side of the rift that the Enterprise can't observe, so it must be on the other direction as well.
Okay,
But everything works out.
And after a appropriately pregnant pause, there's a big explosion.
Yep.
And everything is resolved.
Reused from the Wrath of Khan. And we see the Enterprise being flung free. And as they're flying away, this other craft, this
flies in the opposite direction. Yes.
That's kind of
like
cool.
It's kind of like a blue asteroid. I think they repurposed that for the asteroid in DS9, I guess.
Oh, it does look a bit like
it's
the...
It's probably not, but it
like
kind of looks...
Like the comet in the opening credits for DS9.
And yes, we get one of the quotes that we had for this episode from last week where Data...
Sir, as my final duty as acting captain, I order you to bed.
And he does the same for everyone else.
And
this concludes this episode. And director Les Landau, it should be pointed out, blocked this episode out and prefers not to discuss it for reasons he won't elaborate.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
That's quite something.
Oh. And that was the episode.
Yes. Most of the reviews were that it was either terribly boring or one of the scariest Star Trek episodes ever. Sometimes both at the same time.
Which I totally get. This sense of powerlessness... Like, this existential threat, like, hey, we can't function and there's nothing we can do, is terrifying.
Yes. Well, James Hunt of Den of Geek has, however, set us for a challenge. Because he says it's not completely incompetent, but it's hard to imagine anyone loving this episode. So...
James Hunt, you've met your match.
Yes.
Because I kind of do.
I mean, it's like... I'm sorry, I forgot the name of the person who... suggested this episode to us.
Rob McWolf!
Mr. McWolf. I see what he means when he talks about like how it tries to live up to something, which it doesn't, but it kind of does. It does convey a number of fatigue and of terror, and I mean, I guess you can forgive people their apparent incompetence because they haven't dreamt in 2 weeks, 10 days, something like that. It said at one point that the Enterprise is there for 10 days, and it's like a few extra days.
So it's
somewhere in the 2 week range that they haven't slept properly.
But so Rob was specifically hoping for cosmic horror,
right?
Which I think, you know, he's talking about Two Eyes in the Dark, and that there's a gigantic shape that is so large that you haven't noticed it despite looking at it. I think maybe he was hoping that his whole solar system was like an organism,
right?
That needed help, and that sort of veers away, you know. Doing the reverse Twilight Zone twist at the end where it's not even weirder or more terrifying or you utterly failed to grasp it, but no, it's actually much plainer, it's actually really nice in the end.
Yeah, I suppose.
That there were other aliens that were also asking for help and providing it, and by working together with people that you never knew, that the people who were causing this horror... Those being imposed on the entire crew of the Enterprise were doing so because they needed help and they wanted to help.
Yeah. Also, one thing I still have to comment on is Riker's sequin pillow or whatever it is. It's like, you see that pillow that he's sleeping in? It's like one of those wipe them and they turn different. They've got all the little sequins on it or something that you can like. That must be the most uncomfortable pillow ever.
Space pillows.
Yeah. It looks shiny, but it's not like
this
that.
This episode has a lot in it.
Oh, yes.
Because, like, for as much as I sort of criticize how many scenes there are that sort of fizzle out, like, there's a ton of scenes in here. The suicide scene with Worf.
Right. The fizzle out, it means it's like there's no decisive action, but that's kind of the whole flow of the episode.
Yeah.
I would say. That's kind of like everybody's so tired and we're just like, okay, we're just going to get on to the next thing and... Like, try to make it work.
Good point. So I think that's how exhaustion feels.
I think it actually works very well in that regard.
That fatigue feels.
Yeah.
Okay. Do we have a sound effect?
Oh.
Well, no, we don't really have a sound effect for going to the deleted scene.
No, we don't. So in case someone's listening to this episode for the first time, we always have it at the end of the episode. We always try to imagine what is a scene that was filmed but was left out on the cutting room floor.
That we imagine was a little deleted scene.
Yes.
Yeah, it should have been in there.
I've got one.
Oh, tell me.
It's a little musical number. It's like all the 12 dead people in the morgue doing a little Thriller thing with Beverly as Michael Jackson. In the,
This is Thriller. Oh, that would be wonderful. Or maybe Zombie Jamboree by...
Yeah.
Oh, what's his name?
Ooh, good question.
Back to back and a belly to belly, and I don't give a damn because I done dead already. Oh,
Chief,
back to could, back and a belly to belly.
Could you help us out here?
Belafonte!
Thank you.
Harry Belafonte!
Oh, I don't remember. I've heard a lot of Belafonte songs. I don't remember that one. Oh, okay.
You know, Harry Belafonte actually has a connection with Star Trek. I learned this from the excellent book, Phasers on Stun, that came out a few years ago. And it was a quote from Leonard Nimoy.
Okay.
Who had been to a performance, a Harry Belafonte performance, where Harry spent like 20 minutes barely moving as part of his performance, and then suddenly threw his arms up. And it was such a, just like the fact that he'd been so, dancing so small, and then suddenly this energy, just explosive.
Oh, yes.
And that's where he, like, says that he got the inspiration for Spock's mannerisms. Very, very small. And then by the time that he raises an eyebrow, it's just, it's a detonation.
Oh, yes, I can well imagine that. Yeah, very good. Oh.
So I have another, pretty, like, a much more elaborate deleted scene. Because this is far from the first time that the Enterprise's fate is left in the hands of
Data.
Lieutenant Data. Because he's the only one who's unaffected.
Yes.
And he's got to notice by now that, wow, organic crews, they're a huge liability.
They suck, yes.
They keep getting affected by, like, sleep diseases and, like, brain demons. And they get taken over by everything left and right. And I have to save the day quite a lot.
But, I mean, to be fair, the other way it gets played around as well, where they make Data or Lore take over the ship by just locking everybody out.
So I wonder if he's got... You know, almost an existential, like, Russian roulette where he sort of flips a coin, like, do I take over the ship and the Federation this time?
Bing. Or not, yeah.
No, I'll help them out this
time. I hope it's a very weighted coin in that case.
We just got really, really lucky with this coin flip.
I guess.
We've got something cool. So we've got clues for the next episode.
Okay.
Which has been chosen for us by our chief engineer. And this format is really quite brilliant. We realized last time that when he gives us the clues and then not the answer, we sort of run into the problem that we don't know what it is.
Right.
He's given us the answer as well. So here's here's a few. Oh, yeah.
Oh, you're giving them to me? Sorry, I was going to try to find them, but go on, Ed. Yeah.
So, let me see. Here's the first one.
Chief, you're not going to like this.
Which is said by Bashir. So it's a Deep Space Nine episode. So
yes.
It's
Bashir again.
It's kind of his filthy, Chief. Don't you ever clean up in here?
Okay, so it's somewhat...
So this conduit's filthy, yeah. Oh, and
it's a conduit, so they're somewhere in the whatever passes for a Jeffrey's tube on DS9.
Okay, clue number three.
To Worf, I think your wife is here.
Whoa,
that's
said by
strange...
Sisko.
Oh, okay, yes. That's an interesting twist.
I don't want to say anything, but you do look a little on the petite side.
Says Quark. Okay, now, I made the mistake, so I've actually been spoiled by what the answer is, so you're the only one who gets to enjoy this.
The petite side. Is there
Here we
like,
go.
Yeah?
Chief, you're not going to like this. This conduit is filthy, Chief. Don't you ever clean up in here?
I feel like it's...
Mr. Worf, I think your wife is here.
Mr. Worf's wife, but...
I didn't want to say anything, but you do look a little on the petite side.
Is this a holodeck episode?
No, it's a good guess, though.
Because, like, Worf's wife is long dead at this point. I mean, like, the mother of his child, at least. Does he remarry?
Yeah, Jadzia.
Oh, that must be... That's right at the end.
Yeah, so there's got to be season six where they get hitched.
Right, yeah, that's right at the end. Huh.
So, season six, and... I mean, I know which one is going to be because the husband and I are rewatching Deep Space Nine, and we're right here.
Okay,
this episode is
Deep Space Nine, Season 6, Episode 14, One Little Ship.
One Little Ship!
Oh, well, I'm looking forward to seeing that. And that having said, I'm not just going to bed.
Oh, no, press the button, because I changed the sound effect.
Well, you should have told me that.
Oh, wait, no, I didn't. Hold on. Here we go.
The hell is this?
I'm leaving Starfleet.
Energize! Nice.
We hope you've enjoyed this week's episode with your friends Kay and Kaki. Production and editing by your chief engineer Greg, and music by Fox Amore. Join us next time for DS9, Season 6, Episode 14, One Little Ship. Visit joyoftrek.com/links to send us your recommendations, support us on Patreon, or to find us on Twitter. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you for listening to The Joy of Trek, and we'll see you out there.